Ladies and gentlemen, can you take your seats? Well, for me, it's a very great pleasure to welcome John Langmore, with whom I first started having discussions about social justice when we were both working in New Guinea together
35, 40 years ago.
He has had a distinguished career, first as an academic economist, then as a Member of Parliament for this local area, Fraser, which he served with distinction, before going to New York to work for the United Nations as head of the Social Welfare Secretariat, I think that's what it was called, wasn't it, John?
Yes,
and then with the United Nations as on behalf of the International Labour Organization. He's now based in Melbourne, where he has a professorial appointment to the University of Melbourne. I've known him also in connection with Australia 21, where he's been a member of our program on Australia in the world. And if, for those of you who don't know anything about Australia 21, please help yourself to some of the material that's over there, as well as what I think is in your handouts. John's also the author of two recent books, one dealing with America, which I think is a very important contribution, and a more recent one towards firmer ground that's been produced in association with the Australian Collaboration, for which there are copies over there available for $20, and I'd encourage you to read it. I think it's an excellent book, and it reflects some of John's long-standing passion and involvement in the future of Australia. So, John, over to you.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation to speak this afternoon. It's a real delight and privilege to be here. It's a delight because I love Canberra, and it's lovely to be with you within the Uniting Church, which has meant a great deal to me over the years. I go to Uniting Church in Melbourne, in North Melbourne now. But it's also a delight to be on the platform with Eleni, who I have enormous regard for and who leads social justice work in the National Uniting Church with great eminence and commitment. With Jack, who is a very committed, high-quality journalist and editor, and with John, who is a very fine political scientist and scholar. It really is a lovely day. I was asked to reflect on aspects of how to get social justice issues up more effectively. That's a huge topic, so I'm going to talk in two parts. The first about three impediments to social justice in Australia, and then about three issues that I think it's very important that we deal with. Three broad orientations, really, that it's very important that we deal with. Just a few introductory remarks. Is that better? I think the characteristic of the Australian body politic during the last decade or two even has been disengagement. Whilst it's true that many people are involved, and it's wonderful to see a meeting like this, I think on average during the last decade or two, a lot of people have been so alienated or anguished or frightened or disempowered or simply preoccupied with other things that they have withdrawn or been completely passive about public issues. Hugh Mackay writes, "Consumers prefer home renovations to politics, material indulgence to the exercise of social conscience." I think that has begun to change. I think it started to change a couple of years ago, probably, particularly in relation to climate change, when Australia certainly did reach a tipping point. but I think this is still an element, a substantial element of this. I'll come to other comments about it as I go through. But one element of that disengagement, it was not an accident. I'm not wanting to make a political speech, but I do think the previous government did attempt in various ways to discourage public discussion, most notably by attempting to prevent NGOs who were doing government tasks from making public comments about those tasks. And I was very pleased that one of the earlier decisions of the Rudd government was to withdraw that prohibition. And it wasn't always a prohibition, but it was a restriction. Many NGOs in particular areas had to get ministerial approval before they could comment publicly on particular programs. That was so most obviously in the environment, but in the organisation that I'm a chair of, the UN Association of Australia, we lost our funding completely under the previous government because we dared to be critical of the government's undermining of the multilateral system. And I do think that the holding of the 2020 summit was a symbol of an opening up again of public discussion. It wasn't a perfect event by a long shot. I've been talking about that with in the interval, but it wasn't as well organised as it could have been, I don't think. But it did symbolise that the government was trying to encourage public discussion, and that's profoundly important. And it's important that we use that opportunity. And I do think that there's a response to that in the community. In Melbourne this week, we have the Melbourne Writers Festival. And though the public discussions there are well attended, but there are many events like that around Australia. In the first 10 days of July, I was invited to speak at three student conferences, three conferences organised, national conferences, organised entirely by students, all on international issues. One was organised by medical students, and the applications were limited to 500. They got 500 in the first 10 minutes that it was up on the web. They said they could have got another 500 if they had room to take them. That's the most striking example. But another was a model UN, a week-long model UN, that was held nationally and with some delegates from around the Asia Pacific, 550 students, organised entirely by them for a week. And that's pretty encouraging. And the UN Youth Association had its annual conference. Attendance was limited to 10 from each state, and there were some others as well, so it was only about 120. But again, it was organised entirely by students, and they were deeply involved in issues of climate change and human rights and development, and international rule of law and so on. So what's being observed in the United States in relation to the Obama campaign, and that's a very political expression of it, is observable also, at least amongst parts of youth, sections of the youth community in Australia, a re-engagement with public issues, and that's very encouraging. But I wanted to touch on very quickly three impediments to addressing social justice issues. One, just to leap straight into a very concrete issue, is the one about private donations to political parties. The previous government increased greatly from 1,500 to 10,000 donations that could be given that could be given confidentially without declaring who they were from. Now, I'm very glad to say that Labor's announced it's going to abolish that. But it is crucial if politics is going to be conducted fairly and in ways that don't give free kicks to the wealthy and to powerful interest groups, that political donations to political parties, donations to political parties be published, and so that they're transparent and accountable. Principle is profoundly important. We're very fortunate in Australia, by the way, that we have public funding for for elections. That means that if you're not wanting to advertise on television every 10 minutes, that there are substantial funds available to each of the parties and each of the candidates that they don't have to raise themselves. There may be some unease about that, but when I was a member, I used to find that a liberation because it meant I didn't have to spend my time organising fundraisers and I could spend my time serving the electorate and being involved in discussions about policies. You compare Australia with the United States or Japan, and here our politicians can spend a large portion of their time, provided they're committed to doing so, on policy questions, on parliamentary committees, on their ministerial duties, on their electorate responsibilities, without having to seek for that public donations, because they can rely on public funding for a lot of the cost of running elections. But it's very important that when donations are given, they should be published. That's one very concrete and specific point. A second one is about the media. I don't share quite as fully as Jack high regard for the Australian media. I don't think we have one outstanding newspaper in Australia of the quality, I must say, the New York Times. And there are many problems with our media, but the one that is centrally the problem, which he didn't mention, is the concentration of media ownership. The Murdoch Press, News Limited, own more than 110 newspapers in Australia. They are responsible for 70% of Australia's newspapers. There is no developed country, with the possible exception of Italy, that has as concentrated a media as Australia. And when the News Limited is run by a proprietor with very definite political views, which he requires to be reflected in his papers, not in every article that's written, of course, but there's a corporate culture that reflects his views, then this greatly damages public discussion in Australia. Robert Mann, who's not a friend of News Limited, of course, but who's a very able scholar, has written that without the backing of News Limited, before, during and after the invasion of Iraq, it is hard to see how a blunder as comprehensive as Howard's could have had so little impact on his reputation and that of his government. Now, you may not agree with my criticism of the and his criticism of the Iraq invasion, but in my view it was an illegal, aggressive invasion. Australia is shamed more by having participated in the unwarranted invasion of another country than most things that we've done, and this was made possible partly because of the views of News Limited. Of course, Fairfax also owns a substantial number of newspapers, but when you get past News Limited, Fairfax and Kerry Stokes, there's not much, and Packer, there's not much left. So four groups own most media outlets in Australia, and that is not a diverse media. We are profoundly fortunate to have the ABC, but of course the ABC is under great pressure, but the ABC is committed to attempting to represent all views, and that is of immeasurable value to us. SBS is a very valuable outlet as well, and there are a number of magazines and publishers of books which do create some diversity in Australia, but there is less diversity here than in most developed countries, and that is a major problem for us. What do you do about that? Well, one thing the Canadians do is to subsidise new media outlets that start up as a way of helping them get over the hump and get started. I'd like to see that in Australia. I mean, wouldn't that be, just imagine the idea of the Commonwealth Government subsidising for a period or in some grant way new enterprises getting started. It sounds a pretty radical suggestion, but Canada does it. I think really we need another public inquiry into media in Australia, which is set up partly to review the consequences of media concentration and partly to think through ways of increasing diversity. So that's a second area. A third, and the one I want to spend a bit more time on, is the dominance throughout the last quarter century in Australia of the economic liberal ideology. I'm not making a partisan point at all, because it's been as powerful in the Labor Party as it's been in the Liberal Party. Some people call economic liberalism economic rationalism. That's an Australian term that really isn't understood internationally. Internationally, it's more commonly called the Washington Consensus. But it is sometimes in Australia and sometimes internationally becomes market fundamentalism, the belief that the market has the power and the right to direct political processes as well as economic processes. There are, of course, many characteristics of market fundamentalism. It's normally involved with aims of reducing the role of the state, reducing public expenditure and taxation, privatising public enterprises, deregulating financial and corporate sectors. Those processes have gone a long way in Australia in the last quarter century. They're not high on the agenda of either party now on the whole, though the idea of reducing public expenditure and reducing taxation is still very much there. Though it has to be said, I profoundly regret to say, that Rudd's statements about education suggest that he sees education as having a more strongly economic purpose than a purpose to do with human development, with education for a civilised society and for personal opportunity, for personal development and fulfilment. Now, of course, education is important economically, but it's also important in enabling us all, in many ways, to live fulfilled lives, and that second goal is getting much less attention. I'm very concerned about the idea that the schools are going to be required to be more competitive places rather than more cooperative places. And I think there's a public debate to be held on that point. But that's not my area of expertise. But it's an illustration of this same dominance of economic liberalism well, it's one symptom of it, I think. Australia did reach a tipping point about the environment a couple of years ago, and it's pretty encouraging to see the strength of the concern about the environment, which is a very different orientation to that of economic liberalism. And of course, it's a very tough issue for government to deal with, because it does involve imposing costs. But that is one move away from economic liberalism. I think there is some disenchantment with this excessive preoccupation with economic criteria, and I think that in part the result of the last election was because many people were sick of being told that only the economy matters, when what they wanted was improved health services and education services and employment and so on. But it's important that the new government reflect that in what it does, and it hasn't done so adequately yet. But it would be possible, in contrast to the economic orientation which has been so dominant for the last quarter century, to evolve public policy towards principally being concerned with well-being and the common good. Well-being, a much broader set of goals. Of course it includes economic security, but it also includes social justice, equity, cultural opportunities, concern for the environment, and so on. There are lots of people who are supportive of that view. I'm delighted to see that even the Treasury has as its departmental goal working towards well-being. Now, whether they understand it in exactly the same way as I do is another question, but it is important that they're expressing concern about the environment and Indigenous people's rights explicitly as part of their brief. And so I think there is some growth of breadth there, and I think you can detect that in many ways. What I've said so far in relation to economic liberalism and the contrast with well-being is pretty general, but I think it does lead, if we were as a country to adopt goals like well-being and the common good, then that would lead on to all kinds of very explicit policy changes. And let me just mention a few, but I think it's very important, for example, that we build up early childhood activities. Why on earth, when we're committed to free, so-called free, at least primary and secondary education, are we not committed to free early childhood education? It's absolutely anomalous. And I think it happened partly because there was a sort of censorious view that women ought to be discouraged from working, but it was also because at the time that childcare and preschool activities and so on were being rapidly increased, was the time when economic liberalism was at its strongest. And so the idea of this large additional area of expenditure was strongly opposed. But I think you compare Australia with other OECD countries. We spend 0.1% of our national income on early childhood education. The average for OECD countries is 0.5. So they're five times higher than us. And that includes many countries like Denmark, for example, where they spend 1% of their national income on early childhood education. Now, why shouldn't we, as a wealthy country, be aiming to do that as well? Anyway, I could go on with lots of examples about building up the education system, improving health services, improving access to affordable housing, reinvigorating multiculturalism, building up the physical infrastructure as well as the social infrastructure, and so on. They're the sort of issues that are discussed in that book, and I won't talk about them anymore. But except to say that there is a great role for groups like this to work to make particular things happen, like taking up that issue of strip searching and taking up one thing after another. I'm very impressed by an Old Testament scholar called Walter Brueggemann, and in his commentary on Kings, he writes, "The Soviet Union did not fall, and South African apartheid did not end because of supernatural intrusion. They ended because of the stirrings of justice and freedom in the small places of history. The working of God is slow, not highly visible, but, so says this narrative, that working is very sure." And we need to keep in mind that biblical struggle for justice and peace, which is such a strong theme in the Old and New Testaments. Now, before I finish, I want to go on just to two other areas where social justice concern, I think, would lead one to do work very naturally. And one, of course, is equitable international development. I mean, it's very important that we, as a wealthy country, be building up our concern for the developing world. And I'm very, it's excellent to see that Rudd is committed to increasing aid to 0.5% from the abysmal 0.3% it was at when Labor won government. But even when we get to 0.5, we'll still be less than the average for the European countries. The European countries are nearly at 0.5 now, and they're committed to getting to 0.7. Five or six of them are at over 0.7. Now, we are a mean-spirited country when it comes to international development, despite the fact that we live in the southern hemisphere where most of the really poor countries are located. One way in which we could build it up without increases in taxation would, of course, be to be more sceptical about military expenditure. It is astonishing that Rudd can promise 2% real growth in defence expenditure until 2016. He said this. Now, that takes it off the political agenda, and that's very nice. But what about our environment justifies that? Where are the enemies who are threatening Australia? I don't want to give a lecture on military strategy, but I do think that it would be timely to have a serious public discussion about whether defence expenditure needs to go on growing when it's got nothing to do, or next to nothing to do, with protecting us against terrorism, and it's got much more to do with simply interoperability with the United States, and the United States now being one of the countries which, under the present administration, which has been most aggressive. I think our national interest would be much better expressed by a firm commitment to the international rule of law, to multilateral engagement, and to a more constructive use of our resources than simply squandering them on defence. I'm being quite direct with you, but there isn't a lot of time, so have to be succinct. The final issue I wanted to mention, which is not even on the political agenda at all, is the issue of nuclear disarmament. And yet it needs to be. There are still 26,000 nuclear weapons, about half of them, about 10,000 of them, are deployed, mostly by the US and Russia. Russia has some more deployed than the US, about just over 5,000. The US has just over 4,000. Between them, those two countries have 2,500 weapons on hair trigger alert. That means they could be launched in a quarter of an hour. That despite the fact that Bush and Putin agreed in 2001 that they weren't in conflict with each other. Now, of course, there's been a bit more tension very recently, but there have not been the adjustments to national military strategy by either the US or Russia, or even the other nuclear countries. Britain's upgrading the Trident. France is working on its nuclear weapons. So is China. This generates the motivation in yet other countries to acquire nuclear weapons. India, Pakistan, Israel have already done so. We know Iran may well be attempting to do so. We don't know whether they are or not. But the motivation for proliferation is increased when some countries say these weapons are vital to our security. If they're vital to America's and Russia's security, why wouldn't they be vital to other countries' security as well? That's the reason for anguish about the issue, There are also reasons for hope. And the principle of those reasons is that there are now quite a number of realist international relations leaders in the US who are saying, we think the only answer to this is complete nuclear disarmament. That includes George Shultz and Henry Kissinger, both of whom were leaders under Republican administrations. It includes Sam Nunn and others who are on the Democrat side. But it's a position that is gaining increased attention in the US. Both Obama and McCain have said we must reduce the numbers of nuclear weapons. Obama has said we must aim for complete nuclear disarmament in conjunction with the others. We're not going to unilaterally disarm, he says, absolutely, understandably and rightly, but we should be aiming for complete nuclear disarmament. Now, there's a lot I could say about this, but won't, except that we are now, because Rudd has set up an international commission on nuclear non-proliferation and disarmament, actively engaged as a player in this international discussion. We are also, of course, actively engaged in it because we're a major seller of uranium. So that we have a moral responsibility to be concerned about it because of the use to which our uranium is put. We also now have a political engagement with the public, with the global discussion. And that does create opportunities for contributing to what should be the outcome. And it seems to me that even though the idea of nuclear disarmament is astonishingly complex and difficult and raises all kinds of issues of not only nuclear strategy but also conflict resolution and strategic questions of many kinds, nevertheless, that is should be the goal, and just setting that kind of goal lifts the possibility of what might be done, of the steps that might be taken to move towards it. Now, to conclude, it is often rightly said, it seems to me, that the Church has a prophetic role to play in advocating social justice and peace. Sometimes the Church is urged to speak truth to power, and I think that's an important and impressive goal. And of course it was demonstrated clearly by people like Dietrich Bonhoeffer in Nazi Germany. And there are situations where speaking truth to power in our world now, in Zimbabwe or in Burma, for example, is risks death even, and certainly risks great cost. In Australia, the impediment to speaking truth to power is partly that when the task is described in those terms, it implies that we know the truth and someone else has got the power. And of course we don't necessarily know the truth. If we love God with our minds, then we have to attempt to understand situations and understand and analyse particular problems and go to the root of them. I remember a wonderful sermon by Davis McCackie, who was the first president of the Uniting Church, and he was to students, and he was urging us to love God with our minds, and he said that means you should all be radicals. And by radicals he didn't mean being extremists, he meant going to the root of the matter, being analytical, and attempting to think through alternative approaches. And I think that that's a very high calling that all of us should attempt in whatever way is our capacity undertake. At the end of a wonderful book, which I strongly recommend, by Walter Brueggemann, called The Prophetic Imagination, he has many examples, not only of big issues, but also of the kinds of prophetic service to the community which many people in the Uniting Church are involved in. through Uniting Justice or through Uniting Care or through the social justice ministries of many congregations or through the growth of mediation services for the resolution of conflict or through campaigns to reduce greenhouse gas emissions or end poverty or strengthen human rights for Indigenous Australians and asylum seekers. Those are all the kinds of things that I think this commitment to being a radical campaigner, prophetic campaigner for social justice and peace would lead us to undertake. There is a tendency amongst all of us to think that we're powerless, but we're only powerless if we despair, if we choose to despair. Powerlessness is destructive, but it's self-fulfilling. If we both accept the grief with which much of the current state of humanity generates and recognise the hope which is embodied in our faith, we can be strengthened to take initiatives which can make a difference. Those people with clear aims, commitment and determination can and do contribute to improving human well-being and the common good. And to conclude, I quote from a wonderful speech by Robert Kennedy given in Cape Town in 1966, in which he said, "It is from numberless diverse acts of courage and belief that human history is shaped. Each time a person stands up for an ideal or acts to improve the lot of others or strikes out against injustice, they send a tiny ripple of hope, and crossing each other from a million centres of energy and daring, these ripples will build a current which can sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression and resistance."